Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the aftermath of the election, protests have broken out in cities around the country, even a small one in Charlotte. The governor's race remains too close to call. We look at some of the other races that may have been eclipsed by the dramatic nature of the presidential contest. CMS has their own vote on the magnet lottery changes, and County Commission has a debate about affordable housing. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We're joined by WFAE's Tom Bullock and Mary C. Curtis, a columnist for Roll Call and a contributor to NBC BLK, NPR, and WCCB News Rising. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
And our two Erics are here. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
By the way, that piece of music that opened the show, not our regular theme, is one of our winners in our contest that we had this summer, and four of our contest winners are here. So throughout the show, we'll be hearing their contributions. Roger, who is the organist at Boiling Springs Baptist Church, Roger Lowe, that was his composition at the beginning of the program. Roger, thank you. By the way, you can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Anger and frustration on one side of a divided nation fueled Donald Trump's election to president. The election fueled anger and frustration on the other side, leading to protests in a couple of cities around the country and some graffiti here and there around the country. We had a minor protest, only about 30 people. Why? Are we protested out?
Well, you know, I think a lot of these have been spontaneous protests, mm-hmm. and so maybe that just reflects, you know, people have not really organized anything, and so it was a smaller group. Remember, this is likely not the last. We are just on our way to the start of the Trump presidency, and so you know, there are a lot of raw feelings, as everyone knows. And so I don't think that we can just say this is the last word, days later.
I think we're going to see a lot of nationally what we saw here in North Carolina, where you have a conservative Republican, sort of legislative majority trying to govern a much more diverse populace than the people in power are. And you had all these Moral Monday marches, you know, all these things that happened, and it just kept happening. I think you're going to see that on a national level.
Do you think the protesters in the various cities around the world, a lot of them are young people, did they vote?
Well, no.
That's a great question.
No, I mean, there's no question when you look at the numbers. That's one of, you know, there's so many things to unpack, which we're about to start doing, but that's one of the fascinating things for mm-hmm. all the Moral Mondays, for all the expressions of frustration and anger, both statewide and nationally. I mean, you look at those numbers, African-American votes down. Donald Trump won evangelicals by
– Well, which he's been doing all year.
I mean, but still, you know, it's just things are not – exactly making sense in some way.
He had fewer votes than Mitt Romney.
Well, he had fewer votes than Mitt Romney, who lost in 2012, and John McCain in 2008. But, you know, at the end of the day, he still got...
But a point has to be made that she did win the popular vote. So the country is divided. And for Republicans to come out and say they had this mandate might be a mistake.
But somebody always wins and somebody always loses. And I was trying to think of a time in my life, at least, when anybody protested. And although they have been peaceful protests, they've happened in all the major cities in the country. I cannot think of another time post-election that people have taken to the
even states. Gore Bush, which was, you know, obviously as close as it can be.
But this is a different time, and Donald Trump is a different winner than any we've ever seen before.
It was his campaign slogans, and so much that he said was so divisive mm-hmm. that after this election, you see so many people that he did malign say, wait, what's going to happen to me and their allies? And so it was a much more divisive campaign. And, you know, it's interesting because on Twitter, after 2012, someone dug up and he did say, we should be protesting Obama's presidency.
Mm. So. Well, and the reality of this is I think given the tenor of this campaign on both sides, we would have ended up with protests one way mm-hmm. or the other. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing here, and I think one of the reasons that you see less protesting in a city like Charlotte, I don't think people are protested out. But I think what you did see is you saw President Barack Obama, you saw Hillary Clinton, you saw Joe Biden, you saw Bernie Sanders all come out and say, all right, we respect the process. This was legitimate. Let's wait and see. Let's do what we always hoped if we won that the Trump supporters would do, which is simply stop for a second, give, you know, the candidate they clearly did not like and did not want to win, see what they do with the presidency.
But Tom,
I don't think this is over by any stretch.
I was going to say, but Tom, that doesn't explain why Nashville, why New York, why other cities did protest at much
and it's turned violent in some places.
No, yeah. I mean, so why not Charlotte? I don't really have an answer for you.
In Charlotte, though, we saw the protests and we have all these issues that are still up in the air. I'm with Eric Frazier that I think that you will continue to see them because we're still dealing with issues of economic inequality, of educational inequality, of the jobs issue, of housing, shortage of affordable housing. And so I don't think that Charlotte should be complacent because that's what got us in trouble in the first place.
But that's the question of why is Charlotte complacent given all those factors?
And that Charlotte was 62% of the vote went to.
And not only that, I mean, my God, Hillary and her surrogates were in all of our collective backyards for 6 months, yeah. Saying vote. So it is really it's a fascinating thing that you would have a decrease in voting among some of the populations that are most frustrated with Trump.
Yeah, and Hillary got I was sort of looking at the numbers. Hillary got 6 million fewer votes than Barack Obama did in 2012, and I think
and
that
2012
was
when he lost North Carolina. So this is really bad.
Yeah, and on a national level, I think you know you saw a big drop off from 2012 to 2016 among Democratic voters. A slight drop off from 2012 to 2016 in Republican voters, and that was the difference in the election.
And
people
the
just
things,
did not come out for Hillary.
And one of the things that really is curious to me. Can be disturbing to me, but I'm not full on yet that this is, you know, I'm still trying to dissect the numbers to try to figure out if this was a cult of personality election or if this is truly a new ground in American politics is the fact that the Clinton campaign did what campaigns on a general election are typically going to do, which is appeal to the great American middle. Donald Trump's campaign never tried to do that, ever. So what worries me is, okay, if this is a cult of personality election, that's one thing. That means this is a very unique instance built on anger. And I think both sides will say anger is what drove this election. But if, in fact, that great American middle is gone, that politics has become so polarized, so separated, so extreme –
How did she go after the middle, though? It seemed to me she went after specific groups. She went after African American, Latino, and college educated, and completely forgot those without college educations. I didn't see much of an effort there.
If you listen to the message, I would disagree with you on that one, Eric, because if you listen to the message and the key points that she would put out in policy.
Nobody heard it, though.
But that's my point, my friend. That's the issue. Is the middle gone?
Well, it was a change year, though. It was a change year, and she wasn't a change candidate.
Yeah, I think
that was a big piece of it. Did they misread that piece of it?
Yeah. Well, Bernie Sanders hit those people, though.
For the time. But then he also didn't get votes of the backbone of the Democratic Party, which is minorities.
There's an order.
And the thing of it is, too, is we talk about who she forgot, but we should always remember when they talk about working class voters, they mean white working class. Working class black and brown voters who actually are on paper doing less well economically and have more instability did not buy that message. So even though race was only a piece of it, that was shot through this particular
Donald
election.
Donald Trump turned down the endorsement of the KKK, or so we are told. But the KKK, which I thought was a mythical organization, I thought they had been long gone and assigned to the dustbin of history. But they're going to protest. They're going to march.
Yeah.
In the Triangle of all
sure.
places.
I mean, you've seen that there have been these. You know, even though Donald Trump has, you know, and correctly and as he should, has renounced, you know, their support. They are certainly not renouncing Donald Trump. They are embracing him. They see him as their champion.
A lot of white nationalist groups, you know, too, are surrounding him.
Yeah.
The Steve Bannons and these folks.
Some are hoping to get
jobs in the alt-right, and they are pretty, they're like saying, wow, this is our person, the Ann Coulters of the world, the Rudy Giulianis. There are a lot of minorities who are saying, wow, if he's being floated as Attorney General, does this mean expanded stop and frisk?
Well, that's exactly
love.
What Donald Trump has called for.
And he's called for that. So, yeah, yeah.
But see, here's the concerning thing to me. All of these are legitimate questions and concerns. But if you go through the numbers, that was not the only group that was appealing – that Donald Trump, you know, appealed to directly. Just here in North Carolina, this is one of those issues that really surprised me, or the turnout that really surprised me. He won college-educated white women.
He did.
So we can't – I mean, the race factor, absolutely. That needs to be considered. But like questions about sexism too, sure, I think that needs to be considered. But this is somebody who won college-educated white women by a healthy margin.
Because this also points to people just being – and I think when you hear analysts say this, they're absolutely right, which is people are so frustrated they just want anybody but what they've had.
I want to get back to the protests because Donald Trump tweeted last night about the protesters. He said these are professional protesters who are being incited by the media.
Yeah. Sounds familiar. Think, but then he
are
then
they going to allow him to continue to tweet once
well,
he
they took it away from him.
There's a follow-up tweet that actually is really interesting, right. Which then says, I think it's great that these small groups are going out and doing it. That's America, and you know
somebody got a hold of him
from the desk of Kellyanne Conway.
You're the president now. You have to be president of all the people, just like you promised.
Will he continue to tweet? Is it presidential to tweet?
Well Barack Obama has a Twitter account. Yeah,
I mean, there'll be an institutional Twitter account. The question is, will he have at some points actually take the wheel
actually
and
say,
do it himself?
You bet he's going to still tweet for this simple reason: it has been the most effective way for his campaign.
That's why he won.
That's part of who he is. You know, that's part of who he is. But what you said earlier, too, about the educated white women, there's some numbers that say that some of them were on the edge, but that last week of the Comey letter, the James Comey of the FBI, saying that they might reinvestigate the email scandal, you know, the momentum was going her way, and that a lot of the folks, the independents, the folks on the edge, and we'll never know how much all of these things factored into it and how many of these people are going to come back to the Republican Party anyway. But, you know, these are all factors and we the subject of endless postmortems.
Let me share with you some comments that have come in from listeners as we've been talking. Kelsey emails, I'm a millennial female who voted and campaigned for Hillary Clinton. The protests going on around this country are absolutely infuriating. If the protesters came out and voted with that same passion, the country would not have elected Donald Trump. The millennials are approaching politics in the wrong way, complaining on social media and rioting. There have been no riots.
No, that's not true. Sure, there have been in Portland.
Have there? Okay.
Yeah, really.
Well, all right. Rioting will not make change. Voting in every election and getting involved in local politics is the way to make change. I wish other young people recognize that. Angie tweets, Bernie Sanders would have beaten Donald Trump.
I've heard a lot,
but I'm not sure about that because the Republicans and the Oppo folks were holding their fire because they wanted to you know, run against Bernie, and all of a sudden we'd see things about, did you know he honeymooned in Russia?
speaking of Russia.
Email anyone?
CBS News reported yesterday that a top Russian diplomat has now said that Moscow had contacts with Donald Trump's campaign ahead of the election. Contacts, quote, with influential people in Trump's circle. This had been rumored prior to the election, as a possible explanation for Trump's attitude toward Vladimir Putin. We have to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about this. Is this something that Americans should be concerned about? What would have happened if this had come up on the Hillary Clinton side of things? And this man is now getting the daily presidential security briefing.
He's been getting it for a while.
Well, he's getting the full court press.
He's
getting the real one now.
Yeah.
If he has ties to Putin, should we be giving him that
we don't have a choice.
That's a nice cliffhanger.
We have to stop. We have to stop. We're coming back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls, serving patients in their home or workplace. All insurance accepted. Registration information available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. Never wait in a doctor's office again. And Elon University, committed to redefining higher education with more that matters, including close collaboration between students and faculty and staff mentors. Details at elon.edu. One of the ugliest presidential campaigns in history is now in the history books. In its wake, we are a divided nation. But in truth, we were divided before the election. Both sides of the divide have negative views of the other. Anger and frustration and mistrust are the words of the day. Is this any way to run a country? No. But can these divisions be repaired? With friends and family pitted against each other over politics, where do we go from here? That conversation on this program Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Donald Trump defeats Hillary Clinton in one of the biggest political upsets in American history. Republicans keep control of the House and Senate, and Democrats try to understand the populist wave that led to their defeat.
The Friday News Roundup continues from 10 to noon on the Diane Rehm Show, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
That's Samuel Flynn's take on our little opening ditty. He says he's an amateur ukulele player, but he also works at Station One for Charlotte Fire. So he's in our studio audience today.
Sounds pretty professional to me.
Yeah, doggone right. Absolutely. We're here on the Weekly News Roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer. What about this news that Russian diplomats are now saying that they had contacts inside the Trump campaign? Should we be concerned about that? If the shoe had been on the other foot, would there have been rioting in the streets? And the man now gets the daily presidential security briefing. He knows all of the top secrets, where our operatives are, who they are, what our operations are around the globe. If he has contacts with Russia, should he know that information?
I don't think Trump's a secret, you know, Manchurian candidate.
Oh, that'd make a good movie, though.
But, he is clearly a product of America.
But I do feel like he is easily manipulatable, if that's a word, for Putin and Russia. And that's what, you know, we all have to be on the lookout for.
Well, and there's so much here to untangle, you know, because it could very well be sort of, the Russian propaganda machine as well. I mean, they may have had contact and it may have been, you know, perfectly harmless, or it could be something more nefarious and you have all these people spending. And so we need to get more information before we decide exactly how much this matters.
As soon as President-elect Trump was announced as President-elect Trump, you did get a telegram. And I don't mean that in some kind of a coy sense. It was actually a telegram from Russia, from Vladimir Putin, saying, you know, we would like to try to de-escalate tensions with the United States. You can read into that what you will, but it could just be an honest reset with a new president of a different party. We don't know yet. Mm. But I don't think I think Eric's right. I don't think this is some, you know, crazy Manchurian candidate kind of moment.
You wrote in Roll Call, just not to change the subject, but I'm going to. You wrote in Roll Call, Mary, that the GOP met, and we all know this, decided in 2012 that they needed to take a new direction and bring in people to the fold rather than pushing them away. And this campaign operated in exactly the reverse way. Is that plan now completely dead in the water? And is that, can you sustain the Republican Party in the long term without that plan?
Well, it's a short-term success strategy. He did go after – he said he was going to increase the number of people who vote, and many of them were white, and, you know, not against immigration policies and other things. And he did indeed do that, and that was successful. In the long term, demographics may be destiny. And we see in California, remember the case of Republican Governor Pete Wilson, who had the proposition to take away public services from undocumented immigrants, and he won, and it passed, and it was declared unconstitutional, and California turned blue. It woke up that particular electorate. And look at California now. They just elected an African-American, Indian-American senator. So I think that in the long term, they have to look at a diverse America.
But here's the trick with that, and I think it actually goes back to one of the tweets that you read earlier. The 2012 Republican autopsy is gone. Trump blew that out of the water, period, full stop. But the question is, even if they don't necessarily change, it's whether or not minority voters really start reliably voting, and not just in presidential years. The key races in a lot of ways are midterms. And frankly, Democratic turnout during midterm years is
dreadful.
Dreadful. Yeah.
A lot of that is the policies that they're going to adopt.
Democratic Party autopsy begin?
Oh, no. It's already started. I mean, they're having the fight between Chuck Schumer and Howard Dean and all these people. But I want to say, on Mary's point, let's remember – let's not put this in the category of Republican strategy. Donald Trump. Yeah. No, seriously. I'm not trying to be partisan at all, but Donald Trump came in and blew up the Republican Party. They fought him tooth and nail at every step of this campaign, and they failed and they failed and they failed. This campaign is about a singular candidate who tapped into what was the American zeitgeist. It was not the Republican Party or the Democratic
Party.
Which
is why, Tom, you say that he has a mandate, because not only did he win the election, he also kept the House and Senate for the Republicans. So now they have to do his bidding?
To a certain extent, you bet.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, Mary and I were talking about this 2 weeks ago. One of the harder things for the Republican Party is exactly what ended up playing out if Donald Trump wins. If he loses, they could fall back on that 2012 plan. But the reality of it is, you know, we do talk a lot about popular vote, and there's no doubt Hillary Clinton got more votes than Donald Trump. But in our system, the way it's designed, it's irrelevant. What is relevant to congressional leaders and to Donald Trump is basically he can go down there and say, look, I brought you Pennsylvania, I brought you Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, Wisconsin. I broke the blue wall, and more importantly, I kept you guys from losing the Senate. So now it's time to fall in line with my priorities.
This has to be very concerning for pure ideological conservatives.
Yeah.
I mean, their game is over. I mean, Donald Trump is going to, you know, just remake the Republican Party. And I already see a lot of Republicans that I know who are those types of, you know, really sort of the never Trump, or not maybe not even the never Trump Republicans, but lifelong Republicans who do not embrace some of the more crazier aspects of what Trump has brought, the xenophobia, the racism, the misogyny. And they are now, at least the ones that I know on Facebook, trying desperately to say, I am not that kind of Republican. I'm not the race. I'm not a racist. I'm not a misogynist. I'm not this. I'm not that. But your guy is all those things, and he's carrying your flag. I don't know how you get out from under that. He's going to kill the Republican brand for generations to come, as I see it.
The Observer editorialized that it's morning in America, but a cloudy one on the announcement of the election of Donald Trump. And you listed a series of hopes that you had for a Trump presidency, the last one being, we hope we were wrong about Donald Trump, given that you did not endorse him in the paper. His followers have said, and he has said, that the media was not fair to him. Is this another example of that?
I don't think it's an example of not being fair. We judged him on his merits, you know, as we saw them. And that's what every citizen has the right to do. Now, what will happen going forward will be very interesting between him and the media. For instance, the tradition is that the president-elect, when he makes his first visit to the White House and the Capitol, he lets the media tag along to kind of see, you know, him, you know, chronicle it. And Trump did not, you know. So you can already see that, you know, that wedge that's going to be between him and the media. And I, you know, that's a troubling
thing. He has such a love-hate relationship with the media, in a sense. He hates them, but then again, they made him. He had all the
free publicity. Oh, he doesn't hate them. I don't think he hates them at all.
He plays them like a fiddle.
He hates them in public, you know, at his rallies. And even in the small gathering of supporters, he said, you know, this is my game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, it is Trump's party. The Republican Party is Trump's party. But he said at the convention, I alone can fix this, the country's. So at the same time, there's a lot of expectations on him. The people who voted for Trump and Trumpism, how long will they give him to keep all of those promises? So as you said, Eric, a lot depends upon what happens next.
Well, let's also remember just a little recent history. In 2004, George W. Bush wins re-election. Karl Rove tells us that probably, you know, it's going to be Republican mandate from here on out. 2008, Barack Obama comes out of nowhere and Democrats are ascendant, and we're told the demographics and other factors, there's really not much hope for the Republicans. And so we are in this sort of bipolar, lurching voting habit that, like everything else in our lives, is accelerating cycles at an unprecedented pace.
Yeah. Two warring clans, basically.
Yeah. But redistricting is going to protect the Republicans for a while anyway.
So until the next presidential election.
Let me share some more comments from listeners. John emails, if you look at the map,
showing red and blue. The blue is clustered heavily in New York and California and immediately adjacent areas. The rest of the map is largely red. Geographically, Trump won in a landslide.
But we don't elect presidents on geography.
But in a way, we kind of do with the Electoral College. But here's the interesting thing. It's not just this presidential election where, again, Hillary Clinton won. Mm-hmm. If you look at that, take the House of Representatives, which clearly has been dominated by Republicans for quite some time. I'm willing to bet it would surprise most Americans to know that Democrats have gotten more votes for congresspeople than Republicans. But Democrats are not geographically spread out in an advantageous political way. That is a fact.
Mm. They're clustered in cities.
And
not
that's
just New York. And I mean, look at any,
look at Charlotte.
It's the urban-rural divide. The urban areas have Democrats. Yes. The rural areas have Republicans. Christina writes, do you feel by continuously talking about the issues that divide us, it deepens the divide? When will the time come for us to focus on the issues that are common ground for all of us, the economy, education, health care? Is it possible that the reason for little protesting in Charlotte is because the people are tired of the infighting? I know I am. Justin emails, you still don't get it. You ask about the middle and you say, where did it go? It's there, but it's not where the Democrats think it is. A large part of the population was summarily dismissed by the Democrats as unimportant because they were not in a minority. That is how they lost, and it's pretty obvious. And that is exactly what Rush Limbaugh said on Wednesday afternoon, because I heard him say it.
And here's the thing, you know, We can get into an issues discussion about whether or not the Democrats did not focus on the right groups. But I disagree with the listener's comment because Trump, again, didn't run a middle campaign. You know who did? Paul Ryan. You know who did? A lot of Republicans who basically kind of said, hang on a second, we've really got to think about where we're about to go here. I stand by my comment that, in fact, the middle did not appear. I would argue the people he's talking about were – They migrated. The middle itself is not there, and I'm still waiting to see whether or not this is a one-off or this is a seismic change in America.
So we did a program on Thursday with an economist and two financial planners about what the Trump election may mean for the economy and for business and for taxes and for individuals, and they all said we're going to come out okay on this if he can do what he wants to do. It'll be better for business, they said, better for investors, possibly better for consumers. They specifically mentioned looser regulations for the banks. And considering – I mean, that just took me aback because of the meltdown and because of what could possibly go wrong.
Yeah.
And Charlotte is a banking town. So could fewer regulations and or the end of Dodd-Frank – spell good news for us?
Well, let's define good news. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
For sure.
I mean, we're
going up.
Suddenly,
we're,
fees are back, and you can start investing. I mean,
I don't know. I mean, I think of the spoof you had, Mike, with the Quicken Loans mortgage rocket. What could possibly go wrong?
Where was that? That wasn't on this program.
No, that was on your Charlotte Squawks. But yes, I think that the banks are going to obviously embrace the demise of Dodd-Frank. That seems all but inevitable. But the question is, and I feel silly even asking it, given Wells Fargo and the other things we've seen, is it really a good idea to have less regulation on a group that almost tore the economy
and
down?
And is that what angry, frustrated people want to have?
No, not at all.
I don't think it has anything to do with bank regulations at all. I still think it has to do.
But they were angry that all these banks collapsed. We rescued them with tax dollars.
Yes, that is
and nobody went to jail.
Sure,
they're
but
angry
I think
about
that. I think what's a bigger anger, a bigger motivator, and you and I have talked about this, is not the banks. It's not the great financial recession. It's the fact that their paychecks have not significantly increased since 2000 until earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And they're just now starting to feel that. Now, that is what I think fueled this anger.
I have to disagree with you a little bit. It is that. Obviously, that's first and foremost what voters have in mind. But it is also what Mike's talking about, because there is a feeling among many, many people who propelled Donald Trump into the White House that there is one set of rules for people at the top and there's another set of rules for everybody else. And I do think that unfair, rigged, whatever you want to call that sentiment, I think that was very powerful.
I think the biggest mistake they could make right now, the Republicans, is to ignore that very fact.
Yeah. We're talking about a populist movement.
Yeah, and to try to go back and basically do supply side economics a la George Bush in the early 2000s. If they go back and try to do that same thing and the wealth keeps migrating to the top,
And folks will stay angry, but they'll feel betrayed as well.
Yeah, I agree with you that anger is there. I just don't think it is outweighed by the idea that your paycheck has not increased in 15 years.
Well,
I think
that
is
no
a big...
been no inflation either. So does it matter that your paycheck, if you're doing the same job, does it matter that it hasn't gone up? Because prices really haven't
Mike,
gone up.
Mike, when your health care costs are going up, when your university costs have absolutely
but
skyrocketed.
Eric, most people don't pay for health care. Most people get health insurance through their employer.
Well, but you pay
No. There's so many people who have
the deductibles.
Remember, how many people are working partial jobs and stringing partial jobs together? They're getting absolutely crushed on health care. So that is, right. I would disagree with that.
Trump has blamed the financial meltdown in part on President Clinton's reversal of Glass-Steagall, which kept banks from offering both commercial and investment banking services. And Trump has called for a 21st century Glass-Steagall. Do we know what he has in mind?
No, and this is one of the things that's most fascinating about President-elect Trump that we'll finally start to see. He has so many mutually exclusive statements that now we get to figure out, okay, which one wins out? Because the two questions that you just asked sequentially mm-hmm. are mutually exclusive.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that is one of the things that is most – I mean, it was astounding to watch during this election. But this is the it's easy to go out there and hit slogans, and if you don't like how it's playing out, to change it. Ruling, governing is very difficult and very different. So – grab the popcorn and wait to see what happens
here. I think that point is exactly right. The one I would point to is the fact that he's calling for this massive investment in infrastructure and at the same time a massive reduction in taxes. Those two things cannot be together.
Yes, I brought that up yesterday and nobody had an answer for that because he wants to have a $500 billion investment in infrastructure.
No, it's he said a trillion.
All right, well, God knows we need it, but then he wants to cut taxes.
But he had a notable lack of specifics in his policies.
But it's going to be big.
It's going to be big.
Huge.
We're going to win bigly.
Huge.
We're going to be winning so much, and I'll tell you later what they're going to be. So now we're all waiting.
Do you think he's Do you think he's just going to surround himself with people who understand all of this? Because somebody said yesterday about him in the Congress that this is a guy. I think it was Robert Pittenger. Pittenger said he doesn't like to get down into the weeds. He's a big picture guy,
and that's the fondest hope of congressional Republicans.
Absolutely.
That he
That's
will
right.
just leave the details to him.
To
I
Paul
don't
Ryan.
Know that they're going to get what they hope for.
That would
because
be
Trump
Christmas.
Is an ego-driven individual, and if he feels like it's all Paul Ryan and I'm just signing the papers and I don't really know what I'm signing, he's going to just start changing stuff just so he can say, I did this.
He also railed against. He also railed against in the campaign against the Washington machine and how Washington was corrupt and too many special interests were involved. And he has surrounded himself, I'm told, with lobbyists.
Yes,
advising him on who to pick for
chairman of the FCC. They have a communications person in there trying to pick the chairman of the FCC.
Just other departments. And it's just one of these things where, these are the mutually exclusive aspects, and we're about to see which one wins out.
Okay. No time to get into the next topic because we have to go to a break. But when we come back, we'll talk about the still unfinished governor's race. Could anybody have anticipated that we'd be a week out from the election and we still don't know who the next governor is going to be? We'll take a look at some of the other key races. And believe it or not, there was news beyond the election. I know you're going to find that hard to believe. But
what?
Yeah, CMS magnet schools and affordable housing debate and county commission and more. We'll take it all up as we go through the program at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Novant Health Cancer Care, providing customized treatment plans and a team of professionals to help give patients the support they need. Information available at novanthealth.org/cancer. And the Jazz Arts Initiative. Saxophonist David Finucane plays the music of Joe Henderson Friday and Saturday, November 18th and 19th, part of the monthly Jazz Room series at the Blumenthal Stage Door Theater. Tickets available at blumenthalarts.org. The weekly news roundup continues with the National Hour in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. Donald Trump defeating Hillary Clinton in one of the biggest political upsets in American history. Republicans keep control of the House and Senate, and Democrats try to understand the populist wave that led to their defeat. The International Hour will follow at 11 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation, reach us through email, charlottetalks@wfae.org.
Robin Ciordia, owner of The Secret Chocolatier, a WFAE underwriter. I recommend underwriting with WFAE all the time. It has been the most worthwhile source that we have done for getting our name and our brand out there. I would definitely say that you can get new customers as well as remind your current customers what you're doing and who you are.
Find out more. Email underwriting at WFAE.org for details.
The many voices of Dawn Anthony doing our theme song here this morning. Dawn is a working artist. Actually, she runs Studio 345, which is right up one of the people who's involved in Studio 345, which is right upstairs. It teaches young people how to do what we do. Good Lord, stop.
My daughter's doing that.
And she's also a member of the Charlotte Jazz Orchestra.
Great job. Buy that.
Manhattan Transfer meets the Swingin' yeah. Singers. The governor's race, very tight. Did anybody anticipate it, that it would be so tight that on the Friday morning after the election, we wouldn't have a winner?
You know, Donald Trump was, he helped the down ballot Republicans in most states. And Pat McCrory must be saying, oh, you couldn't pull me right over there at the finish line.
Well, I-77 did him in, is what you're saying,
yeah.
Tom.
Well, I think it was, go ahead.
HB2.
It's a couple of things. But yeah, I mean, if you think about it right now, I pulled the numbers this morning because they seem to be constantly changing. The current rundown is
drum roll.
Roy Cooper leads Pat McCrory by 4,979 votes. And if you actually look at the numbers, and I have to say, you know, the first person who brought this up, I believe was Jim Puckett, but we went through and ran the numbers to compare and see if he had if he was right. And you look at the maps of Mecklenburg County alone in 2012 and in 2016 when it comes to the governor's race. And in 2012, there were two giant red blobs for Pat McCrory, South Charlotte and North Mac. Both of those in 2016, you see a lot more blue than you were expecting. It looks like he probably lost around 15,000 votes in North Mac because of I-77.
Well, and look at this.
And then you have HB2 in the South, too.
Look at this, though. I mean, the biggest number here is that he won Mecklenburg by 3,100 votes in 2012. He lost it by 136,000 votes this year.
Yeah.
I mean, that is obviously many, many times over the deficit that he's facing right now. Now, of course, we still have ballots being counted, absentee and provisional. But
how long might that take?
They're not even going to start doing the canvassing until the
November
18th.
November 18th. Yeah. And then he has till he or Cooper would have until November 22nd to demand a recount. Yesterday, McCrory started a legal defense fund, so we have our very own
Cooper's
hanging
got
Chad
one now as well.
Drama, and
so
Cooper has one,
this is
so.
Gore B. Bush on a smaller scale.
If, if Pat McCrory ends up winning this election by some feat, will he have a better time of it with the legislature this time around because he went out on a limb and gave his full support to HB2?
He'll have the same time of it that he's had before because the supermajorities are still in place. And look, it's Phil Berger and Tim Moore who run North Carolina. It's not the governor. And for people who have not lived in North Carolina a long time, that's a hard thing to grasp that the governor is a much weaker position in our form of government.
Like the mayor of Charlotte.
Mm-hmm. In many ways, yeah.
They don't need him.
Ironically, right. The most powerful Democrat in the state right now, or at least in this particular election, was the Democrat, I forgot his name, who won the Supreme Court seat.
Oh, and Mike Morgan.
Morgan. And tilted the Supreme Court to majority Democrat.
How do you explain that? Seriously.
Well, I think part of it
is that
did
people
go
just
with
no.
Oh, I don't but think. I don't think so at all.
I think that ad that he ran, in which he basically,
but he didn't
pointed,
run it. It was a
well,
outside
yeah,
group,
an outside group that did it for him. But pointing at the incumbent as the guy who wrote, you know, the discriminatory, rules about the congressional redistricting. Mm-hmm. So I think that played a role. And his own ad with the guy in the shower, you know, squeaky clean, that didn't help. That
and also,
one
also,
of the hokiest
party,
ads I think I've seen in a while.
Party isn't on the ballot, so Some people
People don't know.
Right. Well, and, but both of them. I mean, I was actually at the Republican state convention when it looked like there was originally going to be a delegate fight. And, you know, Bob Edmunds, who is the justice who lost the reelection bid, mm-hmm. was proud to say, he's jumping up and down saying, I am the only Republican on here. You have to vote for me or else we lose this election. Right. I think, I mean, there's a couple of different reasons you can kind of play into. But one of the things I think that does make a difference, especially in races where a lot of people don't know who it is, it's called the primacy effect, which is basically people tend to pick the person at the top. I'm not sure, given the margins here, that that played a huge role, because Morgan won by convincing margins, not just kind of like a close race. But so I wonder, it could be the ad, it could be the idea of, you know, the split ticket voting still exists in North Carolina, and they thought, having Republicans control, you know, potentially the governor's mansion, certainly the legislature and the Supreme Court may just be way too much.
Which the split ticket phenomenon is also interesting, because split ticket voting has been declining everywhere for, you know, much of recent history. And yet in North Carolina, I think it's all but impossible to not cite HB 2, I-77, and some of those other issues when you look at the governor's race.
Mm-hmm. And also, Absolutely. You have to click each one now. You can't just click a sign and go Democrats, Republicans.
I want to go back to the governor's race, because I asked you what happens if he wins, if Pat McCrory wins re-election. What happens if Roy Cooper wins? We still have a completely Republican-controlled legislature. Is he just dead in the water? Does he even, he even have to go to work?
Well, no. He'll go to work, and I think the way he'll go to work is he'll try to rally popular support to nudge the legislature on some things. Now, whether he can accomplish that, who knows, but I think that will be the strategy is, okay, I know you have the numbers, but I've got the people on my side and we demand you do X,
and,
Y, and Z.
And there are some places where he can make a difference. For instance, on the coal ash issue, mm-hmm. which is a regulatory issue, you know, this will now be his, if his lead holds up, mm-hmm. he will be in charge of the regulators. He can deal with it differently
than
McCrory did.
He has the benefit of being not the person with the biggest hand on the levers of power. The governor in this situation is kind of like the president when we were just talking about. You know, every 2 years, the legislature's up. If he is out there making a case, he may finally be able to break that supermajority. Didn't happen this year. Could happen in 2018.
Democrat June Atkinson lost her position as superintendent of public schools at the state level. What will that mean for schools as we know them? Anything?
We don't know yet. I mean, I was, you know, the gentleman who beat her, and I'm looking here for his name. I can't think of it off.
I should have written it down. I don't remember his name. I'm sorry.
No. I'll find it here in a second. But it's interesting. If you read his website, it's like he wants to decrease the amount of reliance on testing as a standard. He wants to, you know, to empower teachers. It's a lot of stuff that, frankly, you could see going either way. It's not like he was out there out front saying, hey, guess what? I want every school to be a charter school. I want everybody to do it. So I don't think we really know the answer
Mark
yet.
Mark
Johnson, thank you.
On the morning after the election, this is the latest figure I can find, and maybe it's been decided. That's why I'm going to ask the question. Democrat Mary Belk was up a little over 1% over incumbent Rob Bryan in that state house race. Do we have a winner yet?
She won.
She won.
The rules, just so everybody knows, the recount rules in North Carolina are a bit complicated, but it boils down to this. 0.5% of a margin or 10,000 votes, whichever is smaller. Mm-hmm. So if she, you know, she's at 1%, she won.
Now, right. The night after Election Day, that would be Wednesday, the Mecklenburg County School Board took a unanimous vote in favor of a new diversity-driven magnet plan designed to reduce pockets of poverty in schools. What did they like about the plan? It was a unanimous vote.
Well, I think it was just that the board, this is phase one of mm-hmm. their broader look at student assignment. And this, I think, was, even though the county board of commissioners started making some noise there at the end, I think this was the easiest part of what they're going to try to tackle, because it doesn't make anybody do anything. This is all about voluntary, you know, you can, here are some options for you parents. You can go to these, you can send your, if your child wants to be a doctor, he can go to this magnet that deals with medicine. If he wants to be a computer scientist, he can go to this one that deals with coding. So
what does this accomplish in the short term?
I think in the short term?
Yeah.
Not a whole lot. Not a whole lot is going to change in the short term, because it does not phase in. It does not.
It begins in January.
And the kids who are in different magnets right now. They can stay where they are. And this will sort of phase in gradually and apply to kids who in the future want to go to specific magnets.
So this plan, when it's fully rolled out, I understand, protects guaranteed assignments close to home. It uses choice to break up these concentrations of poverty. And won't that tend to overcrowd some schools and leave other schools underpopulated, if that's the right
word? That's one of the fears.
I don't know if you can say that it will overcrowd magnet schools because they have a set number of seats.
Okay.
So basically, this is a lottery where you opt in by providing financial information. I mean, what they're trying to do is use socioeconomic factors and not just a classic lottery system in order to decide who goes where to basically break up schools so that you basically see. I mean, these are rough estimates, but a third in terms of affluent, middle class, less affluent kind of groups. But yes, it could in theory lead to very low populated local schools in some situations. And the trick, of course, there is with fewer students, you get fewer dollars. Therefore, you get fewer chances to do all sorts of things. And those kinds of schools can be left in a bit of a death spiral if something isn't done to try to change that.
And this is always going to be a difficult debate in a city like Charlotte where you have the neighborhoods. So determined by the legacy of segregation. And you see high poverty neighborhoods and more affluent neighborhoods, and people are going to want neighborhood schools in certain areas. And so you have to figure out a way that's fair to all. But this is people's kids you're talking about. So you're always going to have these debates. How do we do this? And folks in poverty areas, they want their kids to be able to enjoy the high quality schools, magnet schools, all these challenging programs. And sometimes they don't are seen to have as much power when advocating. So it's going to be a tough debate. So when it's totally voluntary, as you say, Eric, how much is really going to happen?
Well, and nobody the problem, as with so many things, is nobody wants to give, right? It's great. Let's try and do this, but wait a minute. Not my kid. I don't want my kid going 45 minutes across town. So that's what they're always trying to juggle.
UNC Charlotte reported this week to the Mecklenburg County Commission on possible solutions to the dearth of affordable or workforce housing. What did they tell the commission? I've stumped the panel.
I was going to say, you got me. I did not cover that one. I don't know.
Yeah, okay. I think, Gary, I think
just to be honest,
we're
I don't
mostly
know.
Been covering this little thing that happened on Tuesday.
But,
well, I'll tell you what they told them.
tell us, Mike.
They said that they told
he them, doesn't need us.
No, they told them the same thing that the Observer's Eli Portillo reported on this week. He reported that the rental research firm Abodo released a new study showing that almost half of renters in all of Charlotte are paying more than 30% of their gross income for rent, making them cost burdened. Mm-hmm. And what the UNC Charlotte study shows is that poorer people are cost burdened. Well, duh. yes. So do these two studies add up to a big problem?
Yes, definitely. I think we all know that this is a problem. I think the question more is, what is the solution? What do we do here? And that's been where city council, county commission, and other, nonprofits that have been trying to tackle this problem, that's where they've been stumped because the market is a very healthy and upwardly driven.
It's a hot market.
It's a hot real estate market.
And you can't really force a lot of these folks when they're developing these apartments to put in affordable units.
You can. They're not willing
to. Our state laws, I mean, we're not like some areas that make it really, you really have to do
it. But how many times have we've had this fight in Ballantyne and other affluent neighborhoods, and there's always a reason. Well, there'll be too much bus traffic. Yeah. There'll be too much this or that.
Oh, transportation.
Right. I really think this is a case of bluster, but no buildings. They love to say we need it, but I have yet to see anything.
Well, Trevor Fuller said one of the messages, and he's the chairman of the county commission, he said one of the messages, I believe, from this election was that people are tired of hearing people talk but don't see any steps to do anything, and it's time to talk. I spoke with Hugh McCall about this earlier this week, and he said, we have got to stop talking.
Yeah.
City Council, after the protest, they said that they were going to accelerate their program to add 5,000 affordable housing units. Believe me, anything is progress. But even if they accomplish that, which, by the way, is a big lift.
Yeah, it's a stretch.
Just a drop in the bucket. I mean, yes, this is a huge problem, and figuring it out is going to be one of the keys to making Charlotte a healthier place.
But we're at a crisis point. My church does Room in the Inn, and the folks who come who are homeless often, these are people with jobs. They're jobs like janitorial jobs, teacher's assistants, retail jobs. They can't afford first and last month's rent. It's women. It's families. This is at a crisis point, so we have to stop talking.
And there was a letter to the editor this week from somebody who said, you know, if you can't afford to live here, move.
Yeah,
and then there was a letter the very next day that said, okay, then who's going to be your teacher? Who's going to be your fire department guy? Who's going to be your police officer? Where are they going to live?
Right.
That second letter writer totally closed the loop and answered the question.
All right. The Panthers won their third. We have to close on some up news here. The Panthers won their third game of the season, their second in a row on Sunday in L.A. against the Rams. They're home again this Sunday against the Chiefs. Do they have it together? Are they back? Is this the Carolina comeback?
They may be back.
How is that for a tepid answer? I'm with you winter time.
Let me just say they beat the Rams.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Will Cam Newton get tackled in the head? Yes, we know this.
Is the NFL taking that seriously, the Cam Newton situation?
I think the NFL doesn't take much of that seriously. What they take seriously is revenue. That's what I
think.
I agree.
Money, yeah.
Wow. Yep. And Mike Tolbert yesterday says it's not my job to protect Cam Newton. It's the NFL's.
Well, he has a point there.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the Hornets are off to their best start in franchise history.
6-1.
There's your real ray of light. The Hornets are on fire.
Get that NBA trophy all shined up.
Right.
We're going to leave you
today with a final piece of music from Kyle Robb, one of our contest winners this summer. He's a sound designer, and he also works at Carolina Healthcare System. Let's have him serenade us as we go out. Thank you very much for the hour. I appreciate it.
Hey, Kyle.